Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. Sitting on the Second Line Road, just a short drive east of the Alderville Memorial on County Road 45, is a white long building next to a very old United Church. The elongated building stretching back from the road is home to the administration offices of the Alderville First Nation. But before that, it was the day school for the local Indigenous community. Prior to that, it was an industrial school dating back to 1838, when the government of Upper Canada decided it wanted to train boys from Indigenous communities. They took these children from their families in Alderville, Mud Lake, and Lake Scugog to turn them into tradespeople. There would be two of these industrial schools built at the time, one in Alderville and the other in Mount Elgin near St. Thomas. These would be the forerunners of the residential schools which the MacDonald government would create in the 1880s and last until 1996. The devastation caused by these schools would crash into the consciousness of Canadians through the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission between 2008 and 2015. We would learn Indigenous families would have no choice. Their children would be taken away to go to a residential school to live far away from home or attend a nearby day school like the one in Alderville. The legacy of the residential school system continues to be felt today. September 30th is Orange Shirt Day. It was started in 2013. Its purpose is to think about Indigenous children in the past, the present, and the future. In the past, we should recall the traumas of the residential school system. In the present, we face the harm caused by children removed from their families to either be adopted or placed into foster care. And in the future, we look to a time when Indigenous children will share the same rights and opportunities as all Canadian children. This past Wednesday, Alderville Chief Dave Mowat addressed Northumberland County Council to talk about Orange Shirt Day. Before he spoke to them, he sat down with Consider This to share his own ideas, thoughts, and personal reflections. He also shared his personal stories about those he knew who were touched by the system. Here is my interview with Chief Dave Mowat. I'm so pleased to have with me today Alderville Chief Dave Mowat. Welcome to Consider This.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
What is Orange Shirt Day?
Orange Shirt Day... The issue surrounds a woman by the name of Phyllis Webstead, and she was from a First Nation in BC. And when she was going to head off to residential school, her grandmother had given her a new orange shirt. And then when she arrived at school, she had all of her clothes taken. Like, all the kids had their clothes taken away, the kids that arrived there, and that included her brand new orange shirt. And she never saw that shirt or her clothes again. And so to her, that commemorates, or that reminds her of her experience at the residential school in BC. And so it's marked now across the country on September 30th.
Why is that important, or why is that significant? What are we trying to remember, or what are we reflecting upon?
It's steeped in history, and what we should be reminded of is how the First Nations, and not just First Nations, but Inuit and Métis, had no control over their destiny because they were removed from their homes forcibly in thousands of cases and taken away from their families and from their communities. To be assimilated by the schools. And what ensued was thousands of cases of abuse. horrific abuse in a number of cases. So it's a 100 years of a story that went untold. It was a crime against indigenous people, and it was covered up. And even though there were whistleblowers, they were silenced as well.
When you reflect on Orange Shirt Day, what do you think about?
In my presentation tomorrow for Northumberland County Council, I will touch on my father-in-law and his experience, and I will touch on how that experience as understood and experienced by my wife, his daughter. I've incorporated some of that, of his experience, into my presentation, because his experience produced a beautifully illustrated children's book and also a beautiful piece of woodland art that also interprets the story that was published about him. And so that's an experience that, of course, I knew him personally, and we were good friends. And of course, I'm married to his daughter, so that's a pretty close connection to a firsthand experience in residential school. So that's probably the first thing that I think about. Another issue is, I'm going to say about 22 years ago, I got a phone call from an Alderville member. She was in Vancouver then. And she knew that I was a local historian. And so she called me up and we talked. And I knew who she was, and I understood when she was born. And then she told me when her mother died in 1938 or 37. Yeah, I think 37. Her mother died when she was 5. And by 38, she was taken away to Chapleau, to the St. John's residential school there. And then her main purpose of calling me was that she had never seen a picture of her mother. And so I happened to have a picture of her mother from 1911, when her mother was the same age as she was when her mother died. So it was quite an amazing telephone call. And that would be one perfect Alderville example of what Orange Shirt Day means.
I was wondering if
about that. I've thought about her, and I've thought about the fact that I don't know if she ever saw, I don't even know if she ever came back to Alderville, but how you wouldn't really be allowed to grieve, and how would a little child grieve anyway? How would she have understood all of that, of what happened to her mother? And then we'll probably never, ever know what she experienced when she was taken away.
I was wondering if we could go back a bit and talk about your father-in-law.
Yeah, so his name was Leo Sagosige. And he was born in Cutler, Serpent River First Nation, which is up along the north channel of Lake Huron. And he was born in 1931. And so, I don't know the specific dates when he went to St. Peter Claver's, but it would be the 30s. That was in Spanish. There was two schools there built there around 1913, a girls' school and a boys' school. And so Spanish is only maybe 5 miles from Serpent River. So he wasn't all that far. From the reserve. And so but he went there, and we didn't hear, and I didn't hear these stories until later, my wife, when she was in college doing her BCE, one of her assignments was to write a story, and I'm not sure what the basis of the subject for the course was, but anyway, the story was about her father. She wrote this story about her father, and she called it making tracks. And Ben Suris, my friend, visited us one time, and he read the story. And he was intrigued by that story. And I guess it must have planted a seed in Ben's mind, because I guess we'd have to fast forward probably another 10 or so years. And then he asked, basically, I guess he got the blessing of the family to write his story and write it in create a children's book. And it was illustrated beautifully, and it's called The Boy Who Walked Backwards. And the story, the message is that when he would go home for Christmas, he didn't want to go back to school. And so there's a big culvert in Cutler where the trains go over. It's a huge culvert, actually. And he would walk backwards in that culvert in the snow, so that if anybody was looking for him, they wouldn't be able to find him, because they'd think somebody came out of the culvert, not walked into the culvert. So that's why it's called The Boy Who Walked Backwards, because he used the deception of his footprints in the snow to hide from those who wanted him to go back to the school. How much it's embellished, I don't know, but it's a beautiful story, and it's a beautiful book, actually. Very beautifully illustrated, and it's in every school in Manitoba. It's in some of the schools in Ontario, and so that's sort of the legacy of Leo Sagoski.
Do you know what it was like for his life when he was in the residential school, or what he experienced there?
Well, he did talk about how, I know that by the 30s, they were outlawing the children from speaking the language. And so they would have to speak in secret, and to be able to protect and maintain the language. He did tell us, though, that they never beat the Indian out of us. And so as much as there was an effort to force the kids from not speaking Ojibwe, they were able to protect and maintain their language, and he was a fluent speaker all of his life.
Was there any residual impact of the residential school system later in his life?
I suppose, as far as parenting skills, I mean, my wife could speak better to me about that. She has spoken to me about it. It's parenting, I guess, parenting skills. They weren't something that the school certainly didn't help to instill in these young people. She was raised by her grandparents, and so that might be one residual effect. He was a very nice man. I know alcohol too would have been a factor in his life, like it became in a number of people's lives. But a hard worker. He told me about the time how he became an Ontario Hydro lineman when he was 17 or 18, and so he put in about a 48-year career with Ontario Hydro.
For those who might not fully understand, what is a residential school?
Okay, so in Alderville's case, I might as well speak locally here, our people moved from the Bay of Quinte and were brought to the new reserve that was surveyed at Alderville in 1835. They were brought here in 1837 and relocated, dislocated from the Bay of Quinte. Failure of the early treaties certainly didn't help. They were brought here, and the main mover and shaker amongst our people was a fellow by the name of William Case. He was an ordained minister, and he was known historically as the father of Indian missions in Canada. And William Case, he helped to baptize Christianize a number of the Mississaugas at the Bay of Quinte beginning in the mid-1820s. And so he had already some experience with the manual labor school process in the U.S. And so what he did is that he implemented that program here in Alderville, It was called the Alderville Manual Labor School. And it's dated around 1839. And physically, I'm sure it was just a structure, a small school built for the kids that on the reserve here. And and then you see by that time, the First Nations now, as far as military allies go, there's no military threat by the 1830s. The American threat is now, history. So the government, not having protected the early treaties, the government not requiring the people as military allies, now they got an Indian problem, quote unquote. And as I always say, our people probably said, we have a government problem. So this moves into the 1840s, and the government strikes a commission called the Bagot Commission. Sir Charles Bagot is the head of this commission. It's probably the first Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples in Canada, probably. And it studies the conditions of our people and the First Nations throughout Upper Canada and Lower Canada. And one of the ideas that comes out of this report is the industrial school. And so the industrial school takes root in the minds of government and the churches, in our case, the Methodist Church, the Wesleyan Methodist. And so in 1849, an actual structure, an actual school is built, and it's called the Alderville Industrial School. And another one is built at Mount Elgin. And these would predate, or sort of a model of the residential school later, but the idea was to bring children from other First Nations to Alderville, and they would learn trades, basic trades, rudimentary education, and work on the farm, etc. And so it was more of a more grandiose plan of the manual labor school. So the industrial school is built in 1849. There are children that come from other First Nations that come here and live here, and then in some cases, a number of cases, they would leave, they would run away, and the parents would come and get them. And by 1855 and 56, the main movers and shakers of this idea, Peter Jones and William Case, are now dead. So that strikes a blow to the plan. Now, the important thing to remember for the audience is that we're talking pre-Confederation. So in the 1850s, our people, the First Nations, had their de facto self-governing powers still in place. They controlled their treaty money, they controlled membership, they controlled their lands. And so this is one reason. They also provided 25% of their treaty annuity money to the support of the schools. Those First Nations who agreed to send children here would also provide 25% of their treaty annuity money. So there was a vested interest that these schools should help the kids grow up and be equal with the white man. But the schools become centers where the language is targeted, for one. But the important thing to remember is that it's pre-Confederation. So we moved to Confederation 1867. John A. Macdonald writes most of the BNA Act, and he includes Section 9124. The federal government takes full authority over lands of the Indians and Indians and lands reserved for the Indians. In 1876, the Indian Act is created, becomes a federal statute. Macdonald, who was thrown out of office in 1873, gets reelected in 1878. In 1879, he commissions Nicholas Davin to go to the U.S. and study the residential school system down there. Davin comes back, writes the Davin Report, which recommends how the residential school system could work in Canada. And the Indian Act already being the federal tool that could now implement this plan goes to work by the early 1880s to create the residential school system of Canada. But the important thing to know and to understand is that by the 1880s, by the course of power of the law, by the failure of the treaties, our people were now wards of the government. And children were now made wards of the government. So from 1764, when the British gave our people the Great Wampum Belt at Niagara and brought them into their partnership, in less than a century, they become wards of the government. And it is through, as I say, usurpation and the course of power of the law that our people are relegated to wards. It becomes law. It becomes the law of the land. By the rule of law was a residential school system created. And it became the law of the land that Indian children, and I use the word Indian historically, it became the law of the land that they would have to go either to a residential school or a day school. And if they didn't go, their parents were breaking the law. And so it becomes a brutal system imposed upon the First Nations. The main target was the Western First Nations because there had already been advancements in Indian education in Upper Canada pre-Confederation. So the initial target was the West. But of course, it being federal law, it applied all over Canada. So that's a bit of a long answer.
So what you're telling me, though, is that the Alderville Industrial School was a precursor to the residential school system, and that, in fact, Alderville and Mount Elgin were the two progenitors of that system, which eventually, after Confederation, became the residential school system. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, the industrial school is sort of a pre-model, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's already established the means of taking the Indian out of the child. It's already attempted to do that in the 1850s, and so there are similarities. But I think the important thing to remember is that the law was now on the side of the church and the government to make this happen.
Yes, I noted that when you in your comments that yeah. There was an investment, a monetary investment, as well as some influence in the industrial school system, but that was gone by the time we come to the residential school system.
Yeah.
So in that regard, though, did the industrial school in Alderville keep going?
No. The last treaty annuity money sent to the school was, I believe, March 1861. And so the support waned and ended by March 1861. In fact, by the 1857, 58 are already pointing to the failure occurring. So it ends in 61, but it becomes simply a day school and what can be deemed an Indian day school. So in the words of those documents I've read pertaining to this, it simply went on the provincial plan, quote unquote. Oh, it was no longer deemed an industrial school. It was simply deemed a day school. And so it became law that kids had to go either to residential school or a day school. So the residential school wasn't revitalized under the plan at Alderville. It just remained, it became a day school.
And therefore, would that mean that there would be local children that would be coming there? The residential schools,
yeah.
I know they stayed at the school and they lived at the school and
yeah.
There was a dormitory. But for the day school, it meant that young people in the community would go to that school and that's where they would
that's
attend.
Right.
But the programs yeah. would be the same and the goals would be the same of assimilation.
Of the end goal, yes.
Okay.
The end goal. But the religious instruction, if you will, at the residential schools, that becomes an issue of abuse, simple abuse. So with the day school, didn't Edmonton Ryerson, he was one of the architects of the industrial school. He wholeheartedly believed in the industrial school. And some of the quotes of Edgerton Ryerson don't sit too well either. But he was an early advocate, and he, during the 1840s, when the Bagot Commission came down with this idea, it was Edgerton Ryerson who was one of the leading figures in the industrial school idea. And he believed that religious feeling, as he called it, religious feeling should take a precedent over most everything else in the school. But it, again, it's not until the actual official residential school system takes place that the churches, you know, take their authority into different realm altogether. It's 1850s. We'll never know what happened, really. You know, I mean, I've never seen anything in my research to indicate that abuses occurred. Probably did. I wouldn't know, but I don't know. But who knows by that time? But again, it's so long, far gone. There were reports that were put in about the school, but they were just basic sort of points about, you know, how many pigs were raised and how many kids enrolled and what they learned, etc. There was nothing really about children's, issues or parental issues, nothing like that.
Do we know if there's anybody in the community that has a memory or recollection or experience going to the day school?
Okay, so the day school, then, the structure, the original structure that was the industrial school, continued on and existed as a day school. And then eventually it burned down. And the today's existing band office in Alderville, that sits on second lawn beside the United Church, that was built in about 1947. And that was the, at that time, the new day school. And it still is in all, it's still here today. We use it as our administration, part of our administration office. So that was built in 1947. That was the new school. And that Indian Day School, Federal Indian Day School program existed at that school as well. And so there's a number of people in the community today that went to that school.
And what was their experience like?
Well, there was a fellow in Alderville by the name of Jack Lukes. He became a teacher at the old school. My mother went to the old school here in Alderville, and Jack was her teacher. She was born in 1932, so, you know, she went to start going there, whatever, 1937 or 1938. And Jack had started in 1936. Now, I believe he was the first First Nation member to teach at a Federal Indian Day School. So Jack was beloved by our people. He taught in all four close to 30 years, and he taught two generations. I don't think we could say three generations, but he definitely taught two generations. And he was very respected by people. I have never heard one negative word about Jack Lukes. And I think the key was that he was from the community, and that he knew the families inside out. Jack was born in something like, I don't know, 1911 or 1912, so he was an old-timer. He knew everybody, and the kids trusted him. And he always did his utmost, you know, to give them the best education they could get. But the whole intent of the curriculum that he had to teach was assimilation. So
that school closed down, I believe, in 1966. That it was.
Yeah, thereabouts. Yeah, yeah. And then the kids went into the Coburg. They went to Coburg schools in Coburg, or then Rosneath was built in 1967. So that transition occurs around that time.
The residential schools is only one aspect of this effort by the government to remove children from their families and to put them within programs to assimilate them. But I also am aware of the fact that there were also efforts with the same goal where Indigenous children were taken from families to be put either in foster care or adopted out to white families. And I understand that this started in the 1950s and lasted until the 1980s. I've heard it referred to as the 60s scoop. Can you talk a bit about that program and its impact on Indigenous people?
Well, I'll try to give a little bit of insight on that. I'll be careful not to say the wrong thing, but the child welfare system becomes sort of the new monster that our people had to deal with. People on the reserves had to deal with by the 1960s, by the 50s. And there was just, the government seemed hell-bent on assimilating First Nations people and Métis and Inuit, hell-bent on it. And it sure made a lot of mistakes in that attempt. And it sure left itself open to liability in that attempt. I know that when I worked in Northwest Ontario, I talked to people about that in a community up in Treaty 3, back up northwest of Kenora. And because of the imposition of the children's aid societies in that case, they would walk right into and have the authority to go right into the community and just take kids and pull them out of homes. And these kids would be put in foster care and even sent to the U.S. in some cases. I've seen television commercials where kids are advertised for adoption, like marketing little Indian kids for adoption. It's pathetic. It's unbelievable that it occurred like that, and that it was so blatantly racist and so blatantly put out there. But the whole attempt, again, was to undermine the cultural integrity of the communities. Leadership, of course, still being susceptible to Section 9124 of the Indian Act, of the BNA Act, and subject to the Indian Act, pre-charter now, pre-1982, still has no voice and is powerless. And so the leadership are powerless to protect their children from being taken away. So the government has had a very good, and historically, the government had a masterful way of creating poverty in the communities, running our people off the land, charging them for practicing their culture, charging them for harvesting on the land, creating poverty-stricken communities, and then using that as justification to go in and take children. It's just an extension of the brutality of the residential school system. So the 60s scoop is pretty notorious system, and there's a lot of people that, of course, are a product of that 60s scoop agenda. But when I worked up in Northwest Ontario, I remember talking to a number of people who talked about the Children's Aid Society just walking in uninvited to homes. And that was happening in Alderville. I know an elder here in Alderville told me about how the RCMP would just come into homes in the 50s looking for contraband, they would call it booze. Walk right into your home. And people had no authority to say no. So it's not very nice history. The 60s scoop and taking children out of their, I know people that are my age or younger that were adopted out and have only found their birth mother, who might be dead. And they struggle terribly with that because, you know, I'm fortunate enough never to be a product of that, but I know a number of people who were a product of that and how they were sent into the foster parenting system and how they became foster children and how they were adopted out. In some cases, they were adopted by good people. I'm not saying that they weren't, or like they were, I'm not saying that everybody experienced a negative situation, but those that did, and a number of them did, they struggle today with that. And it's very sensitive, you know, it's a very sensitive issue. It's probably the most sensitive issue you could ever talk about.
The residential school system was finally closed down in 1996. And so for between 1950s and 1980s, there were actually two programs going on in Canada that were to sole purpose were to remove children from Indigenous families. That's what we're talking about.
That's right. Two-pronged approach. That's how hell-bent the governments were on assimilating our people. And it was always financial. From the 1840s, they always complained about the financial commitment to maintaining the alliance with the First Nations people. At one time, that alliance was could make or break the colonial powers' survival in Eastern British North America. If you didn't have the First Nations on your side, you were dead in the water. Of course, that shifts throughout history, and we see how the government went to such extremes to undermine the culture of the First Nations people, to dishonor their treaties, to ignore treaty promises, to ignore those alliances, and ultimately how far it went to kill the Indian and the child.
So some of the outcomes of these programs is transgenerational or intergenerational trauma. Can you explain what this is and how it impacts Indigenous families?
Well, I've seen a fair bit of strife in the communities. There's been, and I want to be careful what I say here, there's been, you know, alcohol, for instance, of course, it's famously problematic in the First Nation community. But even that had a military purpose. Alcohol had a military purpose going right back to the 1760s. That's an understudied part of First Nations military and socioeconomics study. Is the use of alcohol right back to 1760s. So alcohol is definitely played a terrible role in the communities. And, you know, being dislocated from your children, you know, there were cases in the that came out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission research where some churches at schools stop reporting on the deaths of children. And so parents, thinking that their children were alive and doing well at the school, their children were actually dead. And they didn't find it out until years later, that their children, when the children never came home, they were dead. And they would never, there's never enough respect to tell, you know, grandmothers and mothers that your child is dead. That happened a lot. You know, I guess breaking down the family unit in such brutal ways, how would that not have a ripple effect from generation to generation? And, you know, there's other examples during the war, during the Second World War, examples of how people were, you know, obviously we all know that, how people were decimated, families were decimated. So the ripple effect of that. But when you keep doing it, when you spend the next 100 years attempting to do it, what's the effect going to be? It's going to be what we see today in cases of high incarceration rates on the prairies, for instance. What's that a reflection of? There's a number of sort of, it manifests this way in a number of methods and a number of ways. It's a dirty, ugly, rotten part of Canadian history. And it was abuse, and it was crime. It was crimes committed all to kill the Indian and the child. And so the trauma, I don't know when it'll stop. I really don't know. We're kind of lucky in Alderville where we have, you know, we're geographically not remote. We have good programming here. We have good staff, good infrastructure. So we are fortunate in that way. But in other communities where the infrastructure isn't there and where it's remote and where it deals with even those geographical factors and pile trauma on top of that, it's a real challenge, a huge challenge for everybody involved. So trauma, and we're just seeing it everywhere. I think now we're seeing it everywhere. We're seeing it across so many racial sort of lines, and we're seeing it in so many sectors of society where people have been beat down for too long. But all you can do is keep your face to the wind and just keep pushing through. In Alderville, I'm proud of Alderville for its diligence in securing strong programming for our community. Going back 30 years now, our leaders over that time have taken full advantage of implementing strong programming for mental health and family addiction. You name it, all of those programs have been well implemented here in Alderville and have provided Alderville a strong base to keep as well as we can.
Part of the Orange Shirt Day, of course, is to focus on children. While we talk about residential schools and the things that were done, the one of the underlying themes, of course, is to focus on children. And children speak to the future. What do you see as the issues and challenges that they face going forward?
I have a huge concern with the environment, actually, myself. I'm really concerned about the environment and the degradation of the environment. And so I would like to see that more of our young people look towards that area or that subject area, because it's been too long that it's that the environment has been overridden. So I have a huge concern with that. All the nice shiny jobs in Toronto, this might not be so shiny anymore, especially living in a pandemic. Sadly, it might change the way in which our kids are educated and the goals that they try to attain. So I would really like to see that our kids get back on the land and continue to strive to learn about natural resources. In Alderville, we're kind of locally famous for our tall grass prairie and Black Oak Savannah, and it's provided opportunity for a number of young people to learn about species at risk and all of those at one time boring subject areas. It's pretty necessary now that we put more effort into maintaining and sustaining and protecting the environment. So I'd like to see where our leaders, including myself, where we continue to hammer at each other about creating opportunity for our kids to get out on the land and be healthy in and on the land and learning about natural resources and a part of their culture that still exists on the land. That's one thing. In Alderville, I can speak from Alderville's perspective and from our example here. Again, when we go back to education, it goes, you know, it's rooted in the industrial school here, but Alderville has a number of students who have succeeded at education. You know, we have lawyers, doctors, a lot of professionals, tradespeople. We have a number of people that are working in all sectors of the economy in America and in Canada. And so we've always taken our education programming serious here. We have a student services program, Alderville Student Services, which for the last over 20 years has acted as a after-school and tutoring program for the children. And it it's helped kids, you know, do well in school as an sort of an addition to their, you know, their in-school activities. And now that we see, now that we're in a pandemic situation here, I see the Alderville Student Services as being even more important in helping in that situation. So, but right now we're under, there's a lot of uncertainty. Right now, as I sit here, just a lot of uncertainty that this pandemic is causing. You know, my wife and I, we raise our granddaughter, and she is here online doing the online curriculum at home here. So it's I really don't know where this is going to go. I really don't know where this is going to go. I don't know what it's going to do to our society. I'm pretty concerned about that, as we all are. I really don't know.
So I know that you're going to be making this presentation about Orange Shirt Day to Northumberland County Council. If there was one thing that you wanted the politicians to walk away with, what would that be?
So just to be clear, the presentation, I've created a PowerPoint, a 40-slide PowerPoint. I don't even know how much time I have, but I'll get through it. I've created a PowerPoint presentation that I want to illustrate how the alliance with the British goes from 1764 to just over a century to wardship. And then I want to show how the coercive power of the law is used as a tool and how federal statutes were used as tools to undermine the First Nations people. So I want to illustrate that and show how that occurred. And I guess what I want our municipal partners to go away with is just a clearer understanding of that historical continuum. I want them to know how it, where it's rooted. I want them to understand how the rule of law was used to undermine the First Nations people. I guess that's what I really want them to understand, is the how the rule of law was used against Indigenous people.
So Orange Shirt Day is on September 30th. That's the official day that it takes place. Where can people get orange shirts if they want to participate?
Yeah, that's a good question. My daughter-in-law and son in Sturgeon Falls, she created a design on a beautiful design on a for an orange shirt that some of them are going to be sent down here to Alderville. The best thing might be for people to call, just call the front office at the band office or the health building in Alderville, because there's a number of designs that are being put out for Orange Shirt Day. So my best advice is to just call up to the band office and or the Alderville Health Services and ask the girls there. So while Orange Shirt Day is the sort of one of the objectives, of course, it's steeped in the history of the residential school. So I had, and being a local historian, I was obligated, you know, personally to illustrate how that alliance track that alliance from the 1760s to the 1880s, and then of course up into the modern era. I couldn't talk about Orange Shirt Day without going right back into the history of the residential school system. So I hope that people go in with an open mind, and that they have a lot of questions, because it's all about learning, and it's all about being active about the presentation. You know, I don't get all emotional about this stuff. I deal with my own emotions away from my presentations. I want my presentations to be ice cold and to deliver the facts as best as I can interpret them. There's no better way to learn as far as I'm concerned.
All that being said, though, how does it touch your heart?
Well, you know, I never forget Violet, the woman I talked about who phoned me at that time 22 years ago and said to me she never saw a picture of her mother. And I think about her. I think about her a lot, actually. I knew her sons. I knew one of her sons. I think they probably were a reflection of what she must have went through, because they had a hard time. I think about her. And, of course, I think about my father-in-law, because he was a product of that. I also think about my own grandmother, who was fortunate enough not to see her kids go to the residential school here in Alderville. I think about her, too, because when women might have trouble in their marriage, say the 1940s, they had no rights. First Nations people had no rights at all, actually. Women had lesser rights. First Nations women had lesser rights. And a woman who might be in a troubled marriage and go through strife, et cetera, that must have been a scary situation for her, to know that if her home became broken by her and her husband separating, then that would give the government and the church the authority to come in and take the kids. So there was always that fear, the fear of having your children taken away. That's another fear that was still real as well in the hearts of mothers, who, even though they didn't lose their children to the residential school, they still lived with that fear. So I'm not a product of the residential school. Historically, I guess I am, but I'm pretty ice cold when it comes to delivering the message, and that's the important thing, because, you know, it's for me, it's important that the message be clear and as well understood as possible. But yeah, it's all around. It's all around me. I probably don't think about it as much as one might think, or I'm thinking about it now, more now, because of Orange Shirt Day, which is coming up upon us, and because I've been asked to give this presentation tomorrow. I've been wrapping my mind around it. And so it has brought up a lot of memories about my father-in-law, Leo, and then, of course, Violet, who called me out of the blue that time. I was visiting a fellow today, a businessman out of Coburg. We went and had a visit. We were at his house in the woods in Trent Hills. And he was inquiring about this Orange Shirt Day thing. He said, so now, would it be okay for me to wear an orange shirt? I said, of course. Please wear an orange shirt. And I thought that was pretty respectful thing to hear from just a normal person, not attached to the First Nation at all. And he was very concerned about whether or not he'd be able to wear an orange shirt. I said, by all means.
Alderville Chief Dave Mowat, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks, Robert. It's been a pleasure.
That was my conversation with Alderville Chief Dave Mowat. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. While we are busy self-isolating, it's important to remember the world has not stopped entirely. If you know of a good story or have an idea for a story, please let me know. You can email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com and include as much detail as possible, especially contact information. If you have any comments, questions, rants, or raves, you can also email me at that same address. Or you can go to my Facebook page, Consider This. Or if you're on Twitter, you can message me at rwash. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this.